Many of you know I'm a true advocate for taking supplementation to optimize your health, and one of the best things you can do is choose the right collagen. Collagen is a building block to your entire body. I was introduced to Sparkle Wellness product Skin Boost Plus about a year ago, and I've been taking it ever since. Now they've launched a new bone strength product that I'm super excited about. New Osteo Boost Collagen is formulated to improve bone mineral density, something we all need to think about as early as age 40. Made with award-winning collagen peptide known as Fortibone, the product really has led to meaningful results for people who need significant improvement in this area, including those suffering with fractures or broken bones. OsteoBoost is a great choice for anyone over the age of 40 to reduce the risk of bone mineral density loss, a major precursor to the diagnosis of bone-related diseases. Right now, you can get any of the Sparkle Wellness collagen supplements from Amazon or from their website, lovesparkle.life. And use my code DRFIT for 20% off. That's DRFIT at lovesparkle.life for 20% off their new product, OsteoBoost. Welcome to the Fit and Fabulous podcast with Dr. Jamie Seaman. Hello, everybody. It's Dr. Jamie, and welcome back to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. It is so wonderful to have you here today. Well, I have an incredible guest, one of my colleagues, Dr. Lindsay Harper. She is a board-certified OBGYN and associate professor of OBGYN for Texas A&M College of Medicine. She's also a fellow of ACOG and a fellow of the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. Dr. Harper is the founder and CEO of Rosie, an award-winning women's health technology company that connects women who have sexual health concerns with hope, community, and research-backed solutions. She's been named Forbes Top 53 Women Disrupting Healthcare, People Newspaper's 20 Under 40, a top innovator in North Texas for 2020, and DBJ Top Women in Tech. Dr. Harper, welcome to the Fit and Fabulous podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that introduction. I'm so excited to talk all about women's sexual health with you today.
Well, I mean, I may be a little bit biased, but I think it's such an important topic that doesn't get the conversation that it deserves, and we're definitely starting to hear more about it. And thankfully, with social media, the dissemination of information is easier for, well, I guess that's probably for better or for worse.
Yes, that's true.
But tell us a little bit about your life and what kind of inspired just even your career as being an OBGYN.
Yeah. So I'm actually originally from Arkansas. I live in Texas now. I always wanted to be a doctor or a babysitter. Those were my two career choices when I was growing up. And so when I was in college, actually, I got a job as a tech at a women's health hospital. And I was like a labor and delivery tech, and I loved it. And so when I got to medical school, you know, everything feels foreign in medical school. But when I got to my OB rotation and sort of the topic of women's health, that felt familiar because I had that experience. And I just loved everything about it. I thought maybe I would be a pediatrician going into medical school, but because I do love children, but I didn't like my pediatrics rotation and I loved my OB rotation. I loved the surgical aspect of it. I loved that I didn't have to take care of men. I had just come off of
no offense, boys, but yeah, I feel the same way.
I had just come off of my this is hilarious. Actually, I rotated at the VA and was in the erectile dysfunction clinic at the VA. And I was like, I'm never taking care of another man in my life, you know? And now that's like, I do sex medicine, but it highlights that I had so much more training for men's sexual health, even as an OBGYN, than I ever thought about for women's sexual health. So, which was covered by the VA in a whole clinic, by the way. So anyway, I learned that I love procedural stuff. I learned that I love taking care and developing relationships with women throughout their life. And I also love, you know, birth. And also, here's another thing that I think a lot of us have in common is just being there during the really difficult moments. And I think that OB and medicine in general allows you that opportunity and that honor. But I think it's in a special way in OB when you're there for women when we really need it, you know? And I think that actually that sort of need and feeling and drive is kind of what led me down the subsequent path, because When I was in private practice, I was having those moments where my patients were coming to me with those true needs around their sexual health. And I felt like I was really failing them. I could maybe help them during a hard time of a cancer diagnosis or of an infertility journey or, you know, whatever else that we deal with all the time. But this sexual health piece was a huge gap for me, where my patients were needing me in a moment of vulnerability and I really wasn't equipped to help them. And so that was unacceptable to me. And that sort of propelled me into the next phase of life.
Yeah, I resonate with a lot of what you're saying. I think people don't realize that OBGYNs are surgeons and that it's such a procedural field, but I do agree with you. I never thought about being an OBGYN. I thought I wanted to be an ER doctor because I grew up in the era of like George Clooney and ER. And
yeah.
I thought it was like this cool job. But then I fell in love with surgery, but then I thought, God, I don't know. I don't want to take out a gallbladder and this and this and this. And then when I went on my rotation, it was like this just magical experience for me, just being around, I mean, life, like literally birth. Like this is something this family is going to celebrate every single year on this day for the rest of their lives. But our job, I always say it's like, you know, 95% of the time it's amazing and 5% it's awful, but it's honestly that 5% that, I don't want to say rewarding, but it's like when women really, really, really have a problem and you're there to hold their hand and to get them through it and to find, you know, something better on the other side of it it really means a lot to us, you know, as healthcare providers to step through that with a patient. So where in your journey did sexual health, I mean, you kind of alluded to the fact that obviously these women are coming to you with a problem that you feel like you don't really have the tools for solution. So give people listening an insight into OBGYN training and sexual health and why now you're so passionate about it.
Yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned, as a medical student, so that means everybody in my whole entire med school class, 150 of us, did a 2-week rotation at the VA and learned about erectile dysfunction and men's sexual dysfunction. But I did not in medical school learn anything about women's sexual dysfunction. In residency as an OBGYN, really the only thing I can recall is we did have a sex therapist come to our like lecture didactics and give us a 1-hour lecture, but it wasn't particularly helpful in my training. And then the other thing that we learned some about maybe was sexual pain, but it wasn't very in depth. It was sort of like, you know, here's some causes of sexual pain. Here's a differential, here are potential, you know, paths you can go down. But that's really the extent of it. And even now when I say that, you know, Rosie is a women's sexual health company, people automatically associate women's sexual health with either sexually transmitted infections or with some sort of reproductive, you know, moment in time. And as I've had a lot of time to reflect on this now, I think that and I am not like a man hater. I am a feminist, but I believe that I sort of am an optimist as well, that everybody's kind of hopefully doing the best they can with what they've got at the time. And I think that because medicine was built by men, that there just hasn't been a take on if a woman is experiencing low desire, why might that matter? If a woman is experiencing trouble with arousal or orgasm, why might that matter? It's been really sexuality for women has been looked at as a function of infection or of reproduction. And outside of that, it's not really of consequence. And so there's left this huge gap for women, even though we address men's erectile dysfunction, you know, all of the things that they experience, we've left a huge gap of silence for women in our training, even in our brain space as women, women physicians, even whenever my patients started coming to me with all these complaints, I didn't even really have a framework for how to address them. I didn't really know the buckets of, you know, desire, arousal, orgasm, lubrication, pain. Like, how can I even classify these patients' complaints in order to think of a treatment algorithm in my mind? So those basic tenets were missing for me. And that leaves all of us as OBGYNs saying really like sad things for the generations before us, like drink a glass of wine or go on vacation or get a new partner. And it's like, whoa, actually these have like many sexual problems have a medical basis. Others of them may have a mental health basis. There may be relationship consequences. Like, I think I have, the way that I like to discuss this with other OBGYNs is, you know, we have been trained to treat depression, even though that's something that maybe we might not think falls under our purview. It clearly does, because so many of our patients are struggling. We have been trained to, you know, put it in a bucket, to write a script for it, to refer for it when necessary, to involve, you know, mental health as possible. And so that's really how I try to help people and physicians to think about sexual health as well. There is a medical component that we as physicians are, you know, obligated to address. And for the rest of the picture, it's not for us to ignore or say it's too big like Pandora's box. It's for us to refer, for us to get an army around our patients to support their sexual health, because 43% of women have a sexual health problem. So nearly half of our patients. And we're really, you know, I think a lot of us now are realizing this, stepping up to the plate, but we still have a long way to go for sure.
Yeah. And I'm not convinced that OBGYNs are always asking these questions, because we have a lot of things to cover in, you know, even just a basic wellness exam. I think it's still a very taboo topic that women don't even want to bring up in their OBGYN office, let alone with their partner or with their girlfriends or to the world.
Yeah. And why would OBGYNs ask about it? You know, to be honest, we haven't been taught the language that is necessary to have these conversations. So many of us are nervous about asking. We haven't been taught the tools to help our patients when they have a problem. So why would we ask a question for which we do not have an adequate response? And to your point, there's, you know, we're not even able to kind of connect those dots. So, the last piece of that is reimbursement. You know, when insurance is reimbursing for men's sexual health visits, but not for women's sexual health visits, that's a misalignment of incentives. So we really have to start at the beginning from, you know, teaching everyone how to talk about sexual concerns to partners, to parents, to providers, then training our healthcare providers and physicians, and then making sure that reimbursement for these really common and serious issues is in place so that when we have those conversations, we're compensated appropriately. And so there's a lot of pieces that need to fall into place, but I think we're making, you know, the early moves necessary to get those things to happen.
Can you unpack that a little bit more? This really big gap and discrepancy in women's and men's sexual health not even just sexual health, but urinary, you know, issues, incontinence, those types of things. And maybe for the listeners too, because we only treat women, you know, maybe kind of balance that with like urology and their specialty. And because I don't think patients really understand. Sure. How doctors get paid, you know, where these imbalances really are.
Yeah, it's so frustrating. And there is so much to unpack here. So we'll start with the sexual health conversation itself. So, you know, on the men's sexual health side, there are 26 FDA approved medications to treat men's sexual health problems. And all of them, to my knowledge, are reimbursed by insurance. So when you go to the pharmacy and you go to get your prescription filled, and they say that'll be a $10 copay or a $40, you know, charge, then that's, you know, what patients expect and what they receive. On the women's health side, there are two FDA approved medications for low sexual desire, neither of which are well covered by insurance. So you go to get your prescription filled that your doctor wrote for you, and it's $700 or $800. I mean, absolutely ridiculous. So there's way less options. And even when those options are offered, the options are not well covered. So that's a huge issue. Another issue is physician reimbursement for the visit. So when we as physicians or men, usually urologists, internal medicine doctors are seeing patients, men patients, for a sexual dysfunction, that type of visit is paid for by insurance. So you send a code in as a physician, the insurance company looks at that code and they say, oh, okay, this is how much we reimburse for that type of visit. On the women's sexual health side, if we send in a sexual health code, that many of them, not all of them, but many of them for which many of our patients, you know, need to be seen, those codes are not reimbursed. So we as physicians are left to sort of add other codes or not see patients for that problem, or certainly just it makes it more difficult to be adequately reimbursed for addressing a healthcare problem that needs to be seen and taken care of. And then when it comes to how much we are reimbursed, right? So if you look code to code, so a good example that I know a lot of us talk about is a biopsy of the vulva, right? The external female genitalia versus a biopsy of the penis. There is a huge discrepancy between how much each of those procedures reimburses. So how much a urologist might be reimbursed versus how much a urogynecologist or an OBGYN might be reimbursed, or OB or a GYN oncologist might be reimbursed. And that's, it's, there's no difference necessarily in difficulty of procedure. They should definitely be more on par or equal. And right now the discrepancies are vast, and that's reproduced across many procedure codes, and well documented in many papers written by our colleagues. And so, you know, the discrepancies are systemic. They are at every level of this. And that is what, you know, when you're a physician on a mission to help your patients with something, when you're met with one after the other reason not to do this all day, every day, or try to incorporate this into all of the things that we're already responsible for, like, you know, cancer screening, depression screening, yep. You know, just a general physical exam, understanding, you know, that we take care of a lot of primary care issues. The things that rise to the top are the things that you're trained for, the things that are, you know, your patients have easy access to treatment for, and the things that, you know, you're reimbursed for. And so when we look at those discrepancies, it really takes a toll on physicians' ability to, you know, adequately learn about, treat, and diagnose patients, female patients, particularly with sexual dysfunction.
Yeah. And, another thing a lot of people don't know is that when you come for a women's wellness exam, your annual exam, yeah. our job at that time is to, you know, screen for, you know, obesity and look at your blood pressure and do your pap smear and screen your family history and do your breast exam and colon cancer. Are you up to date on vaccinations? It's not really to dive into all your problems. Yeah. And it's not that we aren't interested. It's that that's how the system is built. And so then it requires, you yeah. know, another office visit. And so sometimes the hurdles just seem too high for either the patient or the doctor. And a lot of these problems just never get addressed. They just get swept under the rug.
Right. And I think that's an important piece to call out, because a lot of times that's how I will talk to physicians about this. But I think there's also sort of a patient training piece of this, which is to say, hey, your sexual function is really important. It's not going to be able to be addressed adequately at your well woman exam, but it is important enough to come back for a problem visit, which is what we as physicians would know that visit as, because it's, there's just not enough time. There's just not enough bandwidth in the well woman visit to do that. But that doesn't mean that you're getting brushed off by your physician, which I think, and some patients are brushed off by their physicians, not to say that that's not happening. Yeah. That is definitely happening. But if your physician says, hey, like I want to help you with your sexual health problems, come back, schedule another visit to come back and see me. That is an adequate response in the situation we're in with payers and how things are set up to these issues. That is not a brush off. A brush off is drink a glass of wine or join the club or some other, you know, pejorative yeah. statement like that. But coming back for another visit is actually the correct way that these things should be handled.
Absolutely. So you know, took this other path as an OBGYN, became an entrepreneur. You started this company called Rosie. So tell us kind of about that journey, you know, in this new world of femtech and entrepreneurship.
Yes. I mean, it still continues to be crazy. It's crazy every day. I think I'm a little crazy for doing it, but also we're probably all a little crazy for just being OBGYNs. So, you know, it's been such a very, I would say, formative experience in my life and in my professional career. But when I realized there was this discrepancy, I sort of looked at the startup situation for men's sexual health. This was in 2019 that we launched. This was in 2018 that all this investigatory work was happening. And I'm like, wow, there are a handful of successful startups for men's sexual health. You know, an armamentarium of drugs for men's sexual problems. And what in the world are we doing on our side? Literally nothing. And I just, when I started to learn the data, I joined ISWISH, became a fellow. I'm like, nearly half of women have a sexual health problem. Like, what in the world is happening? And we know the effect that those sexual health problems have on our lives. They increase anxiety, they increase depression, they increase relationship, you know, problems and divorce. And just, there's such a need, such an opportunity. Why is this not being addressed? And So that's really my effort with Rosie, is to try to address that discrepancy, to try to bring women's sexual health to the conversation of women's health. And I think that that's something that over the past few years we've been able to successfully do, because, you know, now instead of women's health panels being somebody from a pregnancy company, somebody from a, you know, menopause company, and somebody from a infertility company, now I also get invited, other representatives from the sexual health community get invited to be part of these conversations, because we're rising sexual health, you know, to the level of women's health. It's not some dirty, shameful, like closet business where we need to be hiding with our, you know, porn and vibrators. It's a legitimate sort of medical concern that needs to be addressed as such. And so that has been my effort. And Rosie is, you know, the platform, which is Rosie, is meant to provide patients with evidence-based education. So just like we would want to recommend to our patients a consolidated, sort of safe, curated place where patients can find evidence-based information, behavior health support and tools, you know, coaching, peer support, really a community that is sex positive and that raises the conversation around women's sexual health to where it needs to be. And so this serves a function for patients that we've been able to demonstrate, showing statistically significant improvement in all areas of sexual health after use of Rosie. And another fun fact, the more women use Rosie, the more improvement they saw. So that made me happy. But wow. Also it serves a function for us as OBGYNs too, right? Because now if you ask your patient a sexual health question, because you feel compelled to, because we've convinced you of such, and you're, maybe you're a woman and you know how common these things are, then you have an answer for her, right? You're not left to like figure out what the next five steps are for the patient. You can say, oh, this is so common, right? And I know how serious of an issue it can be in your life. Check out this platform called Rosie. And then she can come to our platform. We can do all of the education for her. We can teach her that 87% of women have orgasms through clitoral stimulation. We can teach her about responsive sexual desire. We can help her differentiate between low desire and HSDD. We can talk to her about all the causes of sexual pain. So we're there to help facilitate those conversations. And then when she's ready, she can come back for that problem visit with you. She's focused in on, you know, what the top concerns are. You can either decide to treat or decide to refer. So we're there really to help the patient in a real evidence-based way, and also facilitate those sexual health conversations for OBGYNs to try to make this process, you know, easier and more fulfilling for all parties involved.
I love that, because as a physician, you know, we sometimes just don't feel armed with the correct tools for our patients, or sometimes we just never, you know, we're educated enough. So even if you only know a small amount, if you have those referral pathways and things like that, you can still make a big difference for your patients. So when you kind of stepped out, obviously this takes a lot of your time. I mean, you're still a practicing OBGYN, right? Like you're doing surgery.
I practice as a hospitalist. So my life has changed in terms of how I practice. I could never do private practice, which is what the situation I was in before, and do this. This is like, this is as much work as being an OB, except I get to sleep during normal sleeping hours. So to put that in perspective, but I still work as a hospitalist, but that allows me to sort of time cap my work, you know, and offer the benefits of hospitalist work. So to clarify, I want to make sure that that's clear.
So anytime a physician, you know, becomes an entrepreneur, people always question, you know, they're just doing this for the money. They're trying to capitalize on, you know, they're trying to prey on, you know, they don't see the time and effort and financial investment it takes to even, you know, start something like Rosie. But I'm seeing a lot of companies coming into this space, femtech, menopause, you know, and there definitely are people that are trying to prey on people's problems.
Sure.
But can you give us a little bit of insight into kind of your journey with building Rosie and maybe some of the barriers you've had to jump over being in the space?
Yeah. You know, I think there's so much going on in women's health right now, and it's really exciting because it's been dead for centuries, right? And so to have, and I think, you know, something that I think is important to call out is sort of there's a baseline, you know, point zero of where we are in women's health today. And then there's expectations of, you know, patients as consumers. And there is a vast discrepancy between what we're able to do, what we're armed to do through data and research and evidence-based protocols, and what women, and even me, and probably you, want and need and expect, right? There's a huge gap. And so this is where all of the innovation is happening, is between what is, you know, available and what we all want the world to look like. And I think, you know, as a physician founder, I have a special sort of obligation and obviously mission that is tied to the data, to the evidence that is in existence, and how to, you know, present that and make that easier to interact with in a way that I would want, and I think my patients would want, and as us as physicians would want as well. There are other companies who are maybe being started by, you know, women who were patients who had a bad experience, or women who believe, as I do, that we as women deserve better, but the data just hasn't caught up, right, to that. Like, for example, AMH as an indicator of, you know, future fertility. That's a good example being sold to patients. But that's not how it's been clinically validated. I would love to see it used for that purpose, right? That would be awesome. We all, especially as women physicians, would love to know about future fertility, but the problem is we just don't. And so we spend a lot of time as OBGYNs, as, you know, people speaking in public about women's health, trying to untangle all of this, like, what's real, what's not real, not to say that we shouldn't be targeting towards more personalized opportunities for us to understand what's happening to our health, but that's just not where we are today. And we cannot get there without the data and the evidence to back it up. And so that's it. I think it's important as a physician founder to highlight what the differences are when you're a physician innovating in women's health than if you don't have that background. So one of the differentiators for us is that really everything on the platform, on the Rosie platform, is from an evidence-based sort of recommendation. And one of them that's surprising is erotica. So people are like, oh, there's erotica on the platform. That's interesting. I'm like, yeah, because it's one of the best evidence-based behavioral tools we have for women's sexual health. And that's why it's on the platform. It's easy for women to find. It's sex positive. It's female pleasure focused. You know, there's lots of great things about that show up in our data. And we're able to prove the things that we're doing are working because the data is so important to us. So Rosie instituted clinical standardized questionnaires onto the platform from day one. So within 8 months of being in the market, we were able to share data about Rosie and our ability to help women on the platform, and have continued to really emphasize and invest in research infrastructure so that not only we can present data about the company and Rosie as an intervention, but also we can give back to what is known to the greater body of knowledge about women's sexual health. And I think when you have physicians as innovators, as entrepreneurs, these pieces of the puzzle are there where they're missing in these other, you know, women's health companies. I do not want to like talk bad about the field in general, but I think as a consumer and as a physician, we already know to be looking for the data and the research, but that's something that may not be as obvious, and it's clearly not, or apparent to patients. And so that's why for us, one of our main ways to spread the word about Rosie was to just tell OBGYNs we were in existence, to share with them the data of how we created the platform and also how the platform works, and then have OBGYNs recommending to their patients. And now we have 8% of OBGYNs in the country recommending Rosie to their patients. I'd love for that to be 100%. It takes time and efforts like this, which I appreciate. But that's different than the way a lot of these other companies have gone to market, which is directly to the consumer, and, you know, may or may not have that clinical data to back them up. So I think the point of that whole, you know, soapbox is that we need more physicians as innovators. And I think we're not set up in our training to pursue that. You know, there's so many thoughts of guilt, like, oh, so much money was invested in my training and now I'm just leaving. And, you know, blah, 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 blah. All of this like narrative where we think, oh, if we leave clinical practice, we are letting the world down somehow. But the way that I view it is, who is better to innovate in women's health than women physicians, women OBGYNs? We get the problems. We also get the medical side of things. We understand the nuances of healthcare that are actually very difficult for outsiders to understand. And that training that was invested in us can go on to do more than we could do potentially day to day seeing patients. Not that that work is not, I mean, incredibly important, because obviously it is, but like, what about at scale? How can we scale our training to make the world a better place for women and our health, right? So I don't think we have to think about as turning our backs on medicine or coming to the dark side or anything like that. I think we can think about it as another opportunity to share the training that we've had and the insights that we've gained from that training and from that experience in order to contribute back to the world. And also just to comment on the finance part of things, like I make less money now than I ever did practicing, even when I first started out. And that's because startup life is real. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It is no joke. I am raising money for the company. The company, any technology company, I will say, and any biotech startup as well, loses a lot more money than it makes in the first few years of its life. Yep. And that's just the reality of things. So for anyone who's thinking that someone who leaves practice to start a startup is doing it for the money, that is a false narrative. And you know, it's really a mission driven. Yeah. It's really a mission driven effort for which I work super hard and I love it. I'm so passionate about it. But it's not for any other reason other than pure passion and pure just need to see this in the world.
I love that. I mean, you can just hear it in your voice, but I think that, you know, just hit what you said home a little bit harder. There's no better people to be helping fix this problem than OBGYNs. We are literally the people who sit in the clinic room and have these conversations with patients, and we can learn so much from our patients. So we've established there's a problem. They can even be part of the solution. And I think that's what's so amazing about, you know, what Rosie is doing is you're able to do these surveys. You're able to track these women. You're able to see, you know, what interventions are actually improving things. And so I was about to ask, you kind of led on to the erotica thing. So I was about to ask, what is the low hanging fruit when you start this app called Rosie?
Yeah.
You know, what's the low hanging fruit with helping these almost 50% of women who have sexual dysfunction?
Yeah. Well, the number one sexual dysfunction is low desire. And that's experienced by 38% of women that they will describe to that they have low desire. So self-reported. And for most
of those
women.
So Lindsay, just to define that. So that's just like, I wake up each day and like, I don't really care about engaging in sexual activity.
It's actually defined by each person who answers the questionnaire. So there's no like, if you want to have sex less than X number of times per week, per month, right, per year, then you have low desire. It's qualified subjective by the woman. It's subjective. Exactly. So if the patient herself says, I have low desire and it is a problem for me, then she has low desire. That's all there is to that diagnosis. Great. Super, super straightforward. But there is a difference between umbrella diagnosis or sort of category of low desire, and then HSDD, which is hypoactive sexual desire disorder, which is what we believe is a change in the neurotransmitters in the brain that have to do with sexual excitation and actually even just being sort of open to sexual cues and receptive to sexual cues. So this is going to get a little technical for a minute, but there's something called responsive desire, which is sort of what accounts for the rest of the women who are under the low desire umbrella, which is 38% of women, but don't meet clinical criteria for diagnosis of HSDD. So it's that other sort of actually larger subset of women that have responsive desire. But none of us talk about these things. We're not taught about these things as doctors. Women don't have any idea what I'm talking about when I talk about this stuff. But what responsive desire means is you're not having spontaneous thoughts of sex. You're not getting spontaneously turned on in the middle of the day. But what happens is that you have responsive desire. So when you're exposed to a sexual cue or stimulus, for example, erotica, for other women, they sort of start becoming intimate and then they feel themselves kind of getting into it. Other women might use porn. There's lots of different sexual cues or stimuli that you could, you know, expose yourself to. Maybe it's even a smell or a song or like a sexy touch or kiss, right? So when you're exposed to a sexual cue, then you start to feel responsive desire because arousal happens in the genitals, much like an erection. The vulva and the clitoris are engorged with blood and you can feel a pulsatile sensation. That's an erection of the clitoris. That's just, it is what it is. And that arousal in the vulva and the clitoris sends signals back to your brain that say, oh, sex sounds pretty good. Like, let's do this, you know? And so it's, instead of sex desire coming from the brain, from those neurotransmitters down to the pelvic floor, where you might experience that pulsatile sensation and the engorgement and erection of the clitoris, it's happening in the opposite way, which is arousal in the genitals first and then desire in the brain. That's a perfectly normal way to experience desire. And there's no diagnosis needed. It's just something that once that's learned, and the patient can kind of see if that's her, then she can tap into that as a tool, right, to accomplish her sexual health goals. So if her goal is to increase desire, she can, for example, use erotica on the platform or wherever else to tap into that responsive desire pathway. And that is something we have seen time and time again. It was established before we started Rosie, outside of Rosie, with just written erotica. There were several studies to show that. That's why erotica was instituted from day one on the platform. And we've been able to replicate that data subsequent to, you know, our launch 4 years ago. And it happens over and over. It's a fun piece of the platform, right? Talking about health and sexual health can kind of feel, you know, kind of heavy sometimes. And erotica just allows us to renegotiate our relationship with sex, explore fantasy, which has not anything to do with reality in most cases, and to, you know, reconnect with our personal sexuality and our sexual health goals as well. So it's a liberating part of the platform that surprised me, you know, and I was like, oh, I'm going to have an app with erotica on it. But hey, you know, it works. It's safer than a prescription. It's much cheaper than a prescription. And, you know, I think women are happy when they learn that there's such an easy way to address the issues that they're facing.
Yeah. And I mean, society provides that too to women, right? Like when 50 Shades of Grey came out,
totally.
Right? I mean, it's like, yeah, I mean, women, it does, it makes it us works. Start thinking in that. And I think, you know, and like, I work so hard every day, right? I've got kids, I've got this. And so I know a lot of women who come into my clinic just say, I just never dedicate any amount of time to even exploring that space. And so I love that you can have something on your phone. Okay. Right. I'm going to go there. I'm going to see and experience it and just check it out. So I think that's so great. So for women who get on the app and they're into the erotica, have you looked at data? Like how much improvement do women see with just using like a basic intervention like erotica?
Yeah. So it depends on why. So Rosie started focused on low desire, but now we have resources all across the board. We have resources for pregnant patients, for infertility patients, for postpartum patients, for patients who've experienced sexual trauma. Partnership problems, partners with sexual dysfunction, breast cancer and sexual function, menopause and sexual function. So it really depends on why the patient is there. But for low desire women, and also for women who have arousal and orgasmic dysfunction, we have seen it make a statistically significant difference, as I mentioned. But we have to make sure that those are not due to medical issues, right? We have to make sure that we've ruled out HSDD, which I give grand rounds on these topics all the time, if anyone's interested. And then we've also ruled out any sort of, you know, vulvar or vascular issue that could be affecting arousal and orgasm. And also another important piece of that category are SSRIs, right? So we have to take a look at the chart from a medical perspective and say, hey, just like I would evaluate a man with erectile dysfunction, what's my clinical framework for evaluating this patient? You know, have we ruled out HSDD? Have we ruled out any structural complaints, vascular complaints? If so, then it is likely that these behavioral interventions will work for her. If the behavioral interventions are instituted and not efficacious, then it's time to involve, you know, another professional, such as potentially a coach, if that's appropriate, potentially a sex therapist, potentially a relationship therapist, right? Because these are multifaceted issues. But once again, we need to start with our jobs of making sure there's nothing going on from the medical aspect. And if that's the case, then many times these other behavioral interventions will be successful.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Okay. So in 2021, Rosie put out this amazing survey called the State of Sex. And I'm always looking back at this thing.
So we're about to release another one, by the way.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Coming out
I'm
in
excited.
April. We're very
good.
Close.
Good, good, good. So one thing we hear about a lot is the orgasm gap. And, you know, so let's say we fixed desire, but now women, you were kind of, you know, saying arousal and orgasm. So in the 2021 data, the people who reached orgasm more regularly, 66% of women said that they could orgasm regularly, but 90% of men said they could. So definitely a big imbalance there in that. Talk to us
and
about why that is.
That's partnered sex, right? That's a partnered sex stat. Yes.
Yep.
So that's what's really interesting. And the data this year shows this again, is that a much higher number of women orgasm, it's in the 90s of women orgasm with masturbation, with self-stimulation. But when they get into partnered sex, when they get into partnered sex, it's in the 60s. But men are in the 90s, you know, regardless. And so it's like, what's going on there? I think I have learned a lot about this from one of my favorite sex therapists. Her name is Lori Mintz, M-I-N-T-Z. Yeah. And she actually is on the Rosie platform as well. She was my very first expert besides myself. So I,
Lori and I did a podcast together. So for people listening, if you didn't catch Lori's episode, go find it.
Circle back to Lori's. She is fantastic. And anyway, so she really talks a lot about this and how, you know, women think, and we see this as OBGYNs, people come to us and think, oh, I cannot have an orgasm through penetrative sex, through penis and vagina sex. What is wrong with me? And why did my partners, all of his previous partners, why was he able to get them there and not me? Well, here's the real answer. As I mentioned earlier, 87% of women require clitoral stimulation to have an orgasm. And nobody knows this. OBGYNs don't know this. We as women don't know this. Our partners certainly don't know it, because we're not taught it. And in the media and in a lot of erotica and porn, women's orgasms are portrayed through penetrative sex, through penis and vagina sex. Going back to our original, you know, conversation about how men built medicine. Well, men also started the porn industry and, you know, are in charge of a lot of the movie studios. And so they know how they think that women experience pleasure. And it's definitely because of, you know, penile penetration. And it's like, well, back up on that a little bit. And so, you know, when nobody's recognizing how women experience pleasure, and we as women aren't taught the tools necessary on how to communicate how we experience pleasure, but also aren't empowered to really feel like we deserve that conversation or that experience, then this orgasm gap is created, right? So when we're by ourselves, we know what we're doing. And when we're with our partners, there's a gap. There's a gap in communication. There's a gap in knowledge. There is some self-perceived, you know, pathology that is actually not even there, right? Because it's very normal for women not to have orgasms that way. So Lori really spearheaded this, but we're all kind of joining in the movement where we need to spread the word about how women experience orgasm. And that is to say that, you know, the way that people think about sex, that script needs to be changed, right? It's not like foreplay, which involves, you know, a lot of, you know, what we would consider activity to get women adequately lubricated. That whole script has to be rewritten, because then the actual sex part, which a lot of us, and I'm using some air quotes for those who are just listening, which a lot of us consider, you know, the penis and vagina sex part, like that's only offering pleasure to, you know, the person with the penis, in terms of resulting in orgasm. So we really have to kind of rethink how we as society define sex, how we as professionals talk about sex, and how we educate both men and women and everybody else about how, you know, people experience pleasure. And that's how we close the orgasm gap. And, you know, I think amongst younger people that is happening, because conversations are happening so much more freely, but there's still a ton of work to do for women in our age group, for medical professionals, for, you know, boomers and Gen Xers and all the people, because people are living their whole lives not experiencing pleasure. And that's just because of misinformation that exists. And it's time for that to be changed.
Absolutely. Okay. So women listening, you guys have heard it multiple times on a few of these podcasts. Women need clitoral stimulation a vast majority of the time for orgasm. A quick story about what you were saying. So a year or two ago, I started working with a few different companies that sell sex toys and clitoral stimulation devices. And I talked to them. I talked to my patients about them. This is like a very open conversation.
Love it.
And I had somebody reach out about a year or two ago, and they said, hey, just so you know, I had submitted your name to my company to come do this speaking engagement, but their feedback was that you promote sex toys and they don't think that we can ask you to come speak.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, I'm literally an OBGYN. So, and I'm like a mom of three girls. But I, when Lori was on the podcast, you know, she said, I grew up in this sex positive home. And it really kind of made me think a lot, like, okay, what does that mean? And I know my mother listens to my podcast, but I didn't grow up in a home where we openly talked about sex and the vulva and like how you, you know, achieve arousal and what orgasm. I mean, we definitely never had those conversations.
But who did besides Lori and like five other people? Like, nobody.
I'm sure
really
it's few and far between.
Yeah. Really. So,
yeah, and I'm sure it's very like few and far between.
Your mom probably wanted to have those conversations, but maybe didn't know how. So normal.
Yeah. So recently a patient knitted me a uterus and recently a clitoris, like the full clitoris, yes. Right? Okay. So they're in my kitchen right now. And my three daughters, we were talking last night at dinner. We're like, okay, this is the clitoris and this is the uterus. And my daughters are turning 8, 10, and 12, and they know how babies are made. And I'm very just like forward with them. Yeah. But it was great. My youngest was like, the clitoris looks like a flamingo. I'm going to call it a flamingo. It's like in her little
Love
like 8-year-old
it.
Mind. Okay, great. Fine. Yeah, it's a flamingo. Fine. But I,
that is
you know,
so cute.
There is definitely a stigma. I mean, even people in my own life just think it's so weird that I talk about sex and talk about, you know, sex toys and things like that. And I, you know, I don't know how to get around the stigma other than just talk about it more.
Yeah. And that's it. We'll just get a little louder. There was a study to support your efforts. There was a study, I think it came out maybe last month, of Cedars, where it's a meta-analysis of looking at vibrators as a recommendation, as a prescription for pelvic floor dysfunction. So you can send that to the next group that talks about how you shouldn't be able to talk about vibrators and also lecture at their institution, because it is an evidence-based intervention. And I'm right there with you. You know, I have vulva puppets and clitoris models and all the things, and my kids are literally the exact same age. So, you know, I think there is so much freedom in offering those conversations, you know, at the time when, in the language that kids are ready for, all things like that. Another one of our colleagues, Dr. Carrie Leff, is doing a program on the Rosie platform for how to talk to your kids at all ages of development about sexual health. And I just think that's so important, just like Lori communicated. And I've learned a lot from her as well. I'm always like, Lori, how did you do this with your daughters? You know, because she's such a wealth of information. But
yeah.
I think we all have so much to learn, and we all want to do better. We want to do better than was done for us, especially when we become empowered in this space. And how can we model that for our families, our partners as well? Like my partner, my husband wants to learn about all this stuff. My daughters and my son, for sure. Our patients' families, you know, the media and what's disseminated out there. Like, how can we model for really everyone in our lives after we've become empowered? And then we just create, you know, more and more people who are kind of on this bandwagon. And that's how movements are created. That's how change happens. It's slower than, of course, we want it to be. There is still stigma involved. But to our earlier discussion, the more data we can put to it, the more medical weight we can put to it, the more, you know, women's stories of how this negatively affects their lives and their health, which we understand all that for men, but we're having to make the case for women. But the more, you know, that we can put to it from a medical perspective, I think the better and more robust and more, you know, legitimate out to other people, not to us, but that conversation gets.
Yeah, I'm like dreaming of the day that vibrators are like DME, durable medical equipment.
Totally.
Like, I mean, they totally, your insurance company covers your
exactly.
Vibrator.
We were just talking about this on a Facebook group of OBGYNs, and I was like, it just needs a rebrand. You know, like, let's just call it something else, because like vibrators are so, you know, taboo. But it's like, oh, whatever, pelvic floor stimulators. I don't care. You know, just like, let's do what we need to do anyway.
Totally. I love it. Okay. So we've talked about erotica. We've talked about clitoral stimulation. I think another, you know, important population that we haven't really hit on is menopause and women after menopause. Yeah. How is that group different than premenopausal women?
Yeah. You know, there's a lot, as we know, as OBGYNs, there's a lot of changes that happen during menopause, and they many times just kind of, you know, slap women in the face, because it's so much physically, it's so much mentally, there's lack of sleep, which is compounds everything. But as estrogen drops, right, which is the case in one other phase of life, like postpartum, if you're lactating, then lots of changes happen related to sex. And the most prominent really is the lack of estrogen in the vagina. And due to lack of estrogen in the vagina, the walls of the tissue get thinner. They become less able to be lubricated, less elastic, so they tear more easily. And this can cause significant issues with sexual pain. And then as one might imagine, but then in addition to that, the changes of menopause, because of the hormones, because of the fatigue, the mental health changes and body image, you know, changes, to speak to a lot of your work, really affect our level of sexual desire as well. And then I didn't mention the decrease in testosterone. So women's bodies make testosterone as well. And that needs to be, you know, a part of the conversation when it comes to sexual health and menopause too. So it's a lot of things at once, none of which are good for sexual health, right? And so navigating, being prepared for these things, having open conversations about them, knowing what the evidence-based interventions are available and also which ones are right for you is a huge part of success. Menopause and sexual health can be, and by many people are, navigated successfully, but it does require open communication with your partner and with your healthcare provider, your OBGYN, whomever that might be, because there will be true medical things that need to be addressed. So it's really important to share information about those things and also to share resources of how to get those interventions as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I have encountered so many patients who have come to me when they've gone through this transition and they're like, hey, listen, my husband is on testosterone and he's taking erectile dysfunction
meds. Viagra.
And and now this problem is like 10 times worse than it was, you know, before, because it's so painful. And if you're having painful sex, why would you ever have desire to participate in that regularly? Yeah. Yeah. So there's definitely solutions and people need to talk about them. And thankfully, I think the pendulum is really swinging with hormone replacement therapy.
Yeah.
You know, for many, many, many years, women were really swept under the rug when it came to optimizing hormones after menopause. And thankfully we're kind of seeing that turn the other way, which is great.
Yes. So, I'm thankful that's happening for us, for our menopause.
Right. Because it's coming.
It's coming.
Quicker than we would like. Okay. So you guys, we're going to switch over to the semen analysis. This conversation has been incredible. So in case I don't say it at the end, please share this conversation with your girlfriends, with your moms, with your grandmas, with your daughters, if you feel like it's appropriate, because these are just things that don't get talked about enough. And so I want to help amplify that message a little bit more. So just to end this out, when I was researching Rosie and Dr. Harper, which I've known about her for so long, but as a new startup company, you know, you're trying to raise funds, you're trying to grow this company. And so, you know, I found some data when you guys were going after investors, but I just think this is like the greatest thing to end with here. So studies have shown that 43% of women in the US have some type of sexual dysfunction, which is basically one in two women who either have low desire, arousal, difficulty with orgasm or lubrication or something else. Everything that Dr. Harper and I have talked about. Furthermore, 75% of women report painful sexual intercourse at some time in their life. That's huge. But physicians have little to no training in women's sexual function. Instead, we just talk about pregnancy, reproduction, surgeries, and other preventative medicine. We've addressed the fact that ACOG, who is our governing body, for those that don't know, American College of OBGYNs, they give some guidance to their members, you know, about well visits and STI screening and pregnancy and all these things, but they really have not given us great resources for this particular problem. And there are some people, ISHWISH, North American Menopause Society, some people who kind of play in this field. But once again, OBGYNs who were surveyed, 61% of OBGYNs felt they were unequipped to discuss matters of sexual health with patients before they learned about what Rosie has to offer. So that's huge. That's huge. But on the other hand, men have endless resources. Like Dr. Harper said, 26 FDA-approved medications that address sexual dysfunction. Women have two. We didn't even get to talk about them, but I'll tell you, I rarely prescribe them because they're not covered and they're not that great. They're not that magical. but, you know, we need more funding, more research in this area. So if you guys feel compelled, if an investor is listening and loves what Dr. Harper's doing with Rosie, reach out to her. But just women in general, go find the Rosie app. Dr. Harper, tell people how they can find it, or if they're an OBGYN, how they can get clicked in and connected with what you're doing.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that. And yeah, there is some, I think, movement with ACOG. I spoke last year at ACOG with Lori, actually, and I'm speaking this year again at ACOG. So if anyone's coming to the national convention in Baltimore in May, please come to my talk. It's on Sunday if you're still going to be there, but I'm so happy to have a spot. And then also, like I mentioned, I'm more than happy to do grand rounds. It's non-branded. It's all just about evidence-based interventions for women's sexual health problems. My Instagram is Lindsay, but my name is spelled differently, Lindsey Harper, MD. I'm obviously on LinkedIn. And then Meet Rosie is just www.meetrosie.com. That's our website where people can check out sort of our approach to things, our inclusivity, the language that we use. And also you can go to either app store, Apple or Android, and download Rosie, R-O-S-Y, to check it out. If you are a practicing clinician of any kind, if you have an NPI, you can go to our website /sign up. So that's meetrosie.com/sign up. And you can sign up and you can, we will mail you patient materials that you can share with your patients. You can have completely free access to the gold level of the platform, which includes all of our group coaching and group workshops. So like that, the one, how to talk to your kids about sex with Dr. Leff. We just did a body image one. We did a how to flirt workshop. We have fun stuff going on all the time that gives providers completely free access to that level. Because it's really important to me that if you're going to recommend Rosie, that you have the opportunity to vet it and check it out for yourself as well. So I would love to connect with everybody on in any of those ways, all of those ways, and really just continue to promote women's sexual health in the conversation of health amongst women and serious conversations with partners, providers, and in groups of women as well. So thank you so much for helping with this effort and, you know, sharing our message too. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Dr. Harper. And thank you everybody for listening. Once again, share this with all your friends and family, and we will catch you all on the next episode. Did you guys love that last episode of the Fit and Fabulous podcast? Well, of course you did. And I want to keep bringing you the most amazing content from the most incredible people. And you can help me by subscribing to the Dr. Fit and Fabulous channel. You guys know where the button is. Just click it. It's the doctor's orders.